Well, I'd like to thank everybody at Birkbeck and RADA for having me here, and all the other readers, Amanda Craig, that was wonderful, and all the student readers as well. And thank you all for coming out on a Monday night to hear stories. So I grew up on Vancouver Island in a hippie wilderness commune. You guys gonna be okay with that? Yeah, I'm not sure I am exactly. It wasn't anything terribly scary. There were no stockpiled weapons and not too much polygamy. But it was in the middle of nowhere. And the result of growing up there was that I spent a lot of time in the wilderness, in the woods by myself, wandering around, just exploring it and experiencing what that was like. And it was a good experience. It wasn't until I left Canada to live in South Korea, where I lived for 4 years, and then for a year here in Bath, that I started to feel the desire to write about my childhood. And as I started to write about it, I began unearthing all sorts of memories. But I also started to remember things that hadn't happened. And one of those things is the central tragedy of Dulaam Road. I'm going to read to you from the opening chapter called The Road. It's easiest if you sit with me on the road, if you watch the breeze weave through the tops of the Scotch broom, if you ignore the dusty gravel and tar and instead focus on the tangle of wild blackberry vines at your feet. There's only one berry on the vine, and it's covered with dust from the occasional passing car. In the distance, a woodpecker rattles off Morse code. When I sit down, the tall grass bends beneath me and I wipe sweat from my forehead. You sit beside me, your feet in the ditch. Heat waves rise from the road into green branches and then disappear into blue sky. Insects hum unseen. A car backfires as its engine turns over somewhere up the road. Dogs bark, first at the noise and then at each other. Finally, the car rolls into view, heading towards the farms, gaining speed as it passes us on its way out. I squint to see the license plate, try to memorize it before it's out of sight. I didn't think you'd still be here, I say. A dandelion top blows past and you reach out. It drifts to within an inch of your palm and then catches a current and floats over your small hand. I tell you I want to explain and show you the places I saw it then, before it happened. A yellow flower from the Scotch broom falls at my feet. The connector box on the telephone pole gives off an electric whine. The dogs stop barking. The grasshopper's wings unsheath as it springs into the air beside me and takes flight. My eyes wander along the bottom of the ditch to a snakeskin lying in the dry grass beside us, almost invisible beneath the roots and tangle of blackberry vines. I watch as the sun dries and curls the lampshade hide. Wood ends pass over it in a thin black and red line. I can feel your eyes on my skin. The woodpecker hammers against a different tree. The wood is harder and the sound sharp. The line of ants has started carrying away tiny pieces of the snake's cast off. I wonder out loud how long it will take them to haul the whole thing. You look at me and stand up. I follow suit, brushing dust from my legs and backside and stepping onto the road. The red-crested woodpecker swoops over us. I never forgot the smells, like dust and then rain on a dusty road, and sounds, like dry leaves under bare feet and moth wings in your ear at night. Then there's the trees and bushes. My words hang on the breeze. You stand looking down the road towards the river. That one's an arbutus, I say quickly, pointing. Spark peels like skin. I pick a long stem of wild grass as you start walking. Heat waves rise and wave around your ankles, and then shimmer higher, your outline blurring into moving colors, fading like a trick of the light, threatening to leave me alone on the road. So I spent a lot of time alone in the woods, but I also spent a lot of time playing with the other kids that were on Dulaam Road, which is a real road on Vancouver Island. And usually I played with the other boys, and we were cowboys. You know, I'm not into gender stereotyping, but we were boys, and that's what we did. But occasionally, there were no boys to play with, and I had the unfortunate experience of having to play with the neighborhood girls. And it was awful. I mean, they were horrible to me. They would always offer to you know, pretend to be cowboys. Yeah, we'll play Lone Ranger or whatever. And then make me get married. I went through, you know, sort of like a monthly wedding ceremony there. And yeah, I mean, it always ended in drama. I remember there were two sisters on the road, and the older one would do the ceremony, and she would always get it wrong and say, you know, do you take this awful wedded woman to be your wife? And then the other one would start crying, and it would be this big soap opera. This is an ensemble novel. There's a lot of characters, a lot of points of view, and it's really hard to sort of know which characters to pick to read from. But the heart of the novel is probably the children growing up on the road. I'm going to read to you a very short section from the point of view of Josh, who is a 10-year-old boy, and he's kind of the hired muscle of the road, and he's been forced to play with the neighborhood girls here. He watched Katie's hands as she pretended they were pistols. All wrong, no kickback. And the sound's wrong too, high-pitched. He never should have agreed to play with the girl, but Matthew would insist on playing by himself again. Why the heck would anyone want to play alone? Katie looked at him, flicking her brown ponytail over her shoulder. They stood on her front lawn, two houses down from his place and six up from Matthew's. Why aren't you shooting? She asked. Because you're doing it wrong. Nuh-uh, my cousin taught me. This is how cowboys shoot. He groaned. She'd said he could have a cookie if he'd played with her, but he was losing his appetite. Say the Indians have us surrounded, said Katie. He sighed but didn't argue, instead lining up the sights on his imaginary rifle and making a proper sound as he picked off a brave. Say you get hit by an arrow, said Katie. What? Why me? Because you're fat, she said. You're a bigger target. And you keep bumping into me. You're a klutz. He stared at the girl for a moment to see if she was joking. She wasn't smiling. He fell over holding his side. At least he could lie down this way. He was tired and the whole thing was getting stupid. He lay flat on his back, hands over his chest, the fresh cut grass pricking the back of his neck. No, said Katie. You're not dead. You have to put one knee up. That means wounded. I know what it means. Hush, said Katie. Don't make it worse. He opened an eye and saw the girl leaning over him, her forehead wrinkled with concern. Still no sign of a cookie, but he didn't feel like going home yet. His parents were there, arguing about nothing as usual. Say I'm a nurse now and I have to take care of you, said Katie. Say I'm getting hungry. Say we fall in love and decide to get married. He sat up. Katie knelt beside him, eyes closed, lips puckered. He stood and ran, not looking back until he'd reached Dulum. Just going to read one more quick bit for you. I'll probably spill water all over myself. So two of the other characters on the road are really importantly linked in the novel. One of them is Irene, and she's a pregnant Korean widow. And her husband's died in the first Gulf War. And she's trying to decide, she has to have the baby in Canada because she's so far along. She also lives on Dulum Road. And she has to decide whether or not, when she's had the child, she's going to stay and kind of make a go of things in Canada, or if she's going to head back to Korea and be with her family. And Al Henry is another character, and he's a painter, and he gives art lessons to the kids on the road. And he sees that Irene's in trouble, and he wants to reach out to her. He wants to find a way to help her sort of integrate into the community or feel at home there. And he can't do it. And he can't do it because he was a Korean War veteran and he's having flashbacks of the Korean War. So I'm going to read to you really briefly from Irene's section so you can get a look inside her head, and then follow it up with one of Al Henry's flashbacks so you can see the trouble that he's having. Irene. She sat on a cushion staring at her feet, her ankles swollen to what seemed like twice their normal size, like her friend Eugene's had been, 8 months pregnant and sitting cross-legged on the floor of her massive apartment in Seoul, only 9 months married, and it had been arranged for. Her father was a politician and he wanted a good match, not a love marriage that might make the family look bad. He did it for me too, Eugene had said. No, Irene had replied. He did it for status. Don't you see that both can happen at the same time? Irene thought of the view from Eugene's apartment, out across the city, over the Han River, all the way to the Granite Mountains, high and jagged, the tops hazy through the pollution. Her friend had raised her brown, tattooed eyebrows. I'm not telling you what to do, but if you marry a foreigner, you know what people will say. She flexed her back and caught herself yawning yet again. Perhaps her mother was right. Perhaps she should return to Korea as soon as the child was born. But she shied away from picking up the phone, instead opening the address book that sat on the coffee table beside her and reading through names in Korean and English, each with a number and address beside it. She laid it back down on the coffee table. The worn oak surface was covered with stains, rings, and scratches. "Scars," she mouthed in English. And then she thought in Korean, "No, hieroglyphics of domesticity." She wrote a Korean name on the table with her finger in Hangul, then Irene in English. She didn't even know what it meant, and it was difficult to pronounce properly. Suhua meant water flower, and she tried to think of the English translation, something like a lily that needed lots of water. Why hadn't she just asked to be called Lily? Not that it was any easier to say. The baby kicked. It wouldn't be long now. She felt a twinge of panic surface through layers of fatigue. The room was too warm, and she stood and pulled open the sliding glass door. A breeze rustled through the draped cedar boughs as she stepped out into the patio. Whispers in Korean, rumors of her running off to Canada. The wind was too gentle. Sorry. The wind was too gentle to move the chimes above the door, but the skin on her arms goosebumped. She shivered and then relaxed, watching the play of sunlight through leaves on her toes. She heard the faint whine of the flying insects that lived inside the massive stump beside her driveway, the one with the bush growing out of the top. She picked perfectly round red berries from it earlier that summer, each one like a tiny paper New Year's lantern. But it had seemed wrong without Joseph, without the husband who taught her the words, huckleberry, cedar, and. She eased herself into a white lawn chair, listening for the plastic to strain and crack as she put her full weight on it. The baby hiccuped and she laughed. Everything around her moved. The breeze carried dandelion tops and birds and clouds passed overhead. She stared up into the sky and felt it begin to turn, as though she weren't anchored to the ground. She gripped the armrest of the plastic chair and took another deep breath, waiting for the feeling of vertigo to pass. "I'm feeling the earth spin, Joseph. Where are you? You are in it now, and you are spinning. Everything moves." Al Henry. That night he sat awake in a tent canteen, wrapped in as many blankets as he could find. The Aussies across the crate table had given up on cards, the air too cold for their bare fingers. Shadow at the tent flap. They were well inside the perimeter, and it was unlikely that anyone could have got through. All the same, he reached for his rifle. A woman leaned into the light, Korean, her face and lips chapped, skin cracked and flaking. "How the hell did she get in here?" asked one of the Aussies. "Piss off," said another, waving her away. The woman shifted her gaze to Al. The light from the lantern played off her black eyes, turning them liquid, mercury, alive. She was wrapped in a few layers, not enough though, and her hair was already frozen. He could have reached out and broken off strands. "Mool," she stammered, then again louder, "Mool." "I told you to get lost," said the Aussie. "Can't carry every bloody gook in the country, can we?" The other Aussie turned his back on the woman, but she didn't seem to notice, instead inching closer to where Al sat. "Mool, Jusail." "I don't speak." Al paused and shook his head. "I don't know." A South Korean soldier ducked his head in the tent, muttered something and dragged the woman out. The whole thing only took a minute. "Don't sweat it," said one of the men across the table. "She probably wanted something for sex. A ride home. Fucking desperate, that's all." Desperate. In the morning, they'd started moving north again, slowly, sometimes on foot, watching the hills, surveillance planes above. Not far from camp, they passed an abandoned cart. As he walked closer, he saw it wasn't empty. Pairs of frozen bare feet hung over one edge, and inside, stacked like ammunition, were row and row of bodies, at least a dozen of them, frozen solid, their shoes and coats gone, a light layer of snow over them in patches. His eyes rested on a woman's face, chalk white, eyes open. It was her. A magpie landed on the edge of the cart, hopping onto the woman's shoulder. He turned away. "Ain't a pretty sight," said one of the soldiers behind him. "Hard to believe I'm getting used to it." Al nodded. They made tracks side by side through the hard snow, the crusted surface breaking with each step, the edges cutting at their shins and calves. "Speak any Korean?" asked Al. "Only a little. Got a book when they told me I was shipping out. Haven't read much, though." "Any idea what mool means?" Sure, that's easy. It means water. Thanks so much.